Lecture 19, The Neurobiology of Aggression, Part 1.
Well, 19 interminable lectures into this course, we are finally ready to try to put some of the pieces of this together. What have we been doing so far? This broad approach we've had, this whole notion you want to explain a behavior, you want to understand the biological components of the behavior, there's this terrible temptation to think categorically, here's how you explain everything with this bit of neurobiological insight, this hormone, this gene, this whatever, and as we've had in this chart over and over, instead is our goal to start with a behavior and to understand not only all these separate buckets, starting with the neurons that played a role 1 second before in producing that behavior, all the way back a gazillion years to the forces of evolution that sculpted the genes that gave rise to the brain, etc., etc. Not only to understand the separate buckets, but to see their interactions. And what we've had so far amid all these lectures were not only introductions to each of these buckets, each of these categories, each of these disciplines, but a sense of how they begin to interact. What we're now going to do in this final stretch of the course is to look at this integration in a far more detailed way, finally looking at a set of behaviors. And as discussed at the end of the last lecture, there's a lot to choose from. We could now try to integrate these different disciplinary approaches to the biology behavior in thinking about sexual behavior or thinking about parental behavior or language use or any of a number of other topics. What we are going to focus on at length here is, in some ways, the most interesting, the most challenging, the most important of topics, understanding the biology of why sometimes we humans can be so awful to other humans, the biology of aggression. Now, as we have outlined here, what we start off with on the far right of our chart is, what does the behavior look like? And this is one of those, when we talk about aggression, you can either start off with a, what's behavior of aggression? We all know that. We don't need to get technical. It's one organism doing something damaging to another organism of its same species. Or, at the other extreme, you could spend your entire career looking at the fact that aggression is an extremely heterogeneous state. Is aggression about a resource that you want that's contested? Is aggression instead completely absent of that? Is aggression about long-term planned behaviors, the person mapping out their assassination years in advance? Is it about instead an impulsive scenario where not only could you have had no more than a second to think, on some level you never did think before lashing out? Is the aggression about complete spontaneity, or is it about a reaction to somebody else's actions? And of course, one of the biggest challenges in making sense of human aggression is we very often can rationalize a way in which all aggression is reactive, all aggression is provoked, all aggression is coming with a very solid rationale, all these different subtypes of aggression. Rather than try to go into that in too much detail here, we will see throughout these coming lectures when certain aspects of the biology of aggression are better explaining impulsive aspects of aggression, premeditated, so on. Probably a good place to start here, though, in terms of making sense of the sheer heterogeneity of these sets of behaviors, is to do one of the things we've been doing throughout the course, which is to try to frame we humans as just another animal. Where does human aggression fit in the context of what other animals do to savage each other? And what's become clear is, just as in lots of other realms of biology, we are the only species that makes tools, we are the only species that communicates symbolically, and those have gone down the drain, we are not the only species anymore that kills. And that used to be seen as a defining feature of human behavior, and we've seen plenty of other species so far in this course that will be violent to each other to that extent. Not merely accidental, an injury that goes septic, but instead, we are not the only species that kills intentionally. Likewise, what's gone down the tubes is we're not the only species that kills infants. And we heard already about the viciously logical evolutionary imperative of infanticide, competitive infanticide in certain species. We're not the only ones who do that. Furthermore, what's now recognized is we're not the only species that kills in an organized way, organized violence, rather than one individual lashing out at another. Groups of cooperating animals trying to do violence unto another, and it's not just humans who have something that vaguely looks like warfare. Chimpanzees, for example, will do something built around a lot of the evolutionary logic we've seen already, which is a band of brothers, and that's a term we will come back to, but in this case, literally a band of chimpanzee brothers or close relatives who will do border patrols at the edge of the territory of their group, and if finding a male from another group will most intentionally go about killing him. We are not the only species with organized violence. Another thing that's not unique to us is we are not the only species that has invented, come up with the idea of hierarchies, structured hierarchies where there's a number 1 and a number 10 and a number 20 with qualities of life working very differently. We're not the only ones who used hierarchies as substitutes for punching it out with nature bloody in tooth and claw over every contested item. We and other species have evolved things like hierarchies as means to rein in some of our aggression. Nonetheless, amid this picture of, oh, we're just like other animals, there's a lot of things that we do as humans when it comes to being aggressive that have to be viewed as human specialties, if not absolutely unique on our parts, nonetheless, things we do like no other species out there to the sheer extent. And one of the things we're amazingly able to do is, just as we can use communication in a very abstracted way, what most animals do when they are communicating is talking about right now, in the present tense, I am happy, I am scared, I am hungry, I'm aroused, I'm angry, whatever, and we instead can talk about philosophy and the Italian Renaissance, and instead, when we get to our aggression, we can have aggression enormously abstracted over place and time. We can be aggressive to someone on the other side of the planet. We can be aggressive to somebody whose face we have never seen. We have a capacity to abstract our aggression like no other species out there. Similarly, another thing that we do like no other species out there, or fortunately only a small subset of us who are among the most psychopathologically troubled of humans, is we confuse sexual behavior with aggressiveness, and that is very much a human specialty. Another thing we do is bring a technology to aggression like nobody else out there. We are the only species that not only has come up with patent offices, but a means to patent weapons, and weapons of mass destruction in some cases. Any other species out there pretty much gets by on its muscles and canines and a few other things. By the time you get to chimpanzees, there will be the occasional use of an object within the realm of tool use. We are the only ones out there where people can spend careers carefully building a better, faster, more efficient, whatever means to damage another member of our species. More aspects of our uniqueness. Even though chimpanzees, as we just discussed, can go about organized violence, we're the only species that has organized violence where the level of organization transcends the local group, the local band. We've invented militaries where, as we will see later, one of the most extraordinary features of it is individuals who are not related in the slightest to each other go about giving up their lives for each other in an organized context of violence. We are the only ones to have organized aggression on a scale well above that of the local community of second and third cousins. Finally, we get to all sorts of subtly weird psychological states. When we think about aggression, we're the only species out there who can be passive aggressive, where we have this ability where we can be extraordinarily aggressive to somebody else, to a certain extent, by in this perfect right condescending tone, telling them, oh, what a great new hairdo. Oh, they hate it. They hate it. I can't believe they said it to me that way. We're the only ones who can damn with faint praise. We're the only ones who could do it in that fashion, being aggressive by not just being cooperative, but being exaggeratedly, ritualistically so, to show how much you're contemptuous of. No other species can do that. Here's a wonderful recent example I heard of the subtleties of human aggression in the realm of passive aggression. And this was the child of a friend of mine in preschool, and she apparently was not getting along with some other kid and frequent squabbles. And this was around Easter, and they were all in there painting their Easter eggs, and some tension broke out between her and this other kid, and she broke the other kid's Easter egg. tears, upsetness, the teacher swoops in to intervene. We do not do that. We respect each other's bodies and properties, and you don't break somebody's Easter egg. And you need to sit down now and paint her an Easter egg to replace the one you broke. So my friend's kid goes off in the corner and grumbly and resentful and painting away, and seemingly some scheme begins to emerge in her after a while. She's painting away and schemingly looks back now and then, and she's up to something or other, and eventually finishes and comes over to the other kid and says, "Here's your stupid Easter egg. Happy Easter," and hands her an egg that's been painted completely black. Hippos wouldn't get what the point is. And suddenly we're in this realm of human aggression where you can follow the letter of the law. You need to paint an Easter egg for this individual, but you can savagely violate the spirit of the law. Easter eggs, bright pastel colors, you don't paint Easter eggs like this unless you're trying to communicate to this kid, they made me do it, here it is, and I don't like you one bit more than 5 minutes ago, and just showing that the other individual was a human and not the hippo, and that this other individual understood the subtlety of human aggression, she promptly broke into tears. Hippos wouldn't get the point. We're the only ones who could do something like that. Finally, there's another feature of aggression that we have to wrestle with, and this is one that is so central to the subject and at a certain level, so at the core of the ways in which we are in trouble as a species. And let me give you a personal example of this. Okay, I happen to play soccer. I happen to be a terrible soccer player. I'm short, I'm slow, I'm uncoordinated, I'm aging, I don't have a whole lot of stamina. Nonetheless, I love playing soccer. Except for the fact that a couple of seasons ago, there was this one guy I was habitually playing against who was younger and faster and taller and more skillful, and on top of everything else was this phenomenally dirty soccer player. And he would spend like half the game elbowing me in my ear and that sort of thing. And there was this one day where I got the ball, and in 2 seconds of brief panic, I was about to like completely boggle it and sort of lamely pass it off to somebody else. And he swoops in and for the umpteenth time steals it from me, and I'm really frustrated with this. And he kicks it off to somebody else, and the two of us, momentum carrying us, still running, off to some corner of the field. And I'm really frustrated that he's gotten away from me yet again, and the fact that he elbowed me in the process of doing that. And we're running along, and I have about a half second to glance back. The ball's elsewhere. Everybody else's attention is elsewhere. We're running along. I'm half a step behind him, just being carried by momentum. And without giving it a thought, I just slip my foot in front of his ankle and just trip the guy up, and he goes rolling. And this is in the middle of like the dry season. We're 8 miles from any substantial amount of water. There's a puddle right there. There's a puddle. He goes rolling into it. I don't even go through the pretense of, "Oh, sorry, how are you?" It was great. For the rest of the day, I was in the greatest mood for doing that. Mother Teresa. You remember Mother Teresa, saintly, fragile octogenarian. What if I had been playing soccer against Mother Teresa and had tripped her up into this puddle of mud there? I would have felt awful about myself. And it would have been the exact same behavior in both of those cases. And here we have, in lots of ways, the biggest challenge in studying aggression. We don't hate violence. We hate the wrong kind of violence. We will pay good money for the right kind of violence. We will get season tickets. We will sit on the edge of our seat. We will give medals to people who are violent in the right way. We will vote for them. We will preferentially mate with them. We've got no problem with violence as a species. We just simply have problems with violence in the wrong social context. And it's the same exact behavior in those two cases. And what will be the biggest challenge of understanding the biology of this behavior is not the biology of why some individuals are so abnormally violent in terms of magnitude extreme, but the biology of why some individuals don't master the rules of appropriate context for violence. And that is something we will wrestle with again and again in these coming lectures. Okay, so as is our strategy now, beginning to move our way backward, leftward on this chart, now having thought a bit about the behavior, we now begin to look at what's the neurobiology of aggression. And as you could guess, where we are going to barrel into is the limbic system. Of course, the limbic system, emotion, all of that. And the first evidence for this was in the 1930s, something that was called the Kluver-Busey syndrome, where this was an experimental technique that was done on laboratory animals. Experimental technique. This was not subtle. This was lopping out the frontal parts of the temporal lobe. This was not a frontal lobotomy. Frontal cortex in that case. The temporal lobe's a different part of the brain. Among other things, taken out a whole bunch of chunks of the limbic system, and afterward you got an animal that was abnormal in its sexual behavior and abnormal in this or that, and an animal with very, very odd levels of aggression. Aha, what people concluded from that fairly crude experiment was this part of the brain has something to do with aggression. And it was in subsequent decades that attention began to hone in on an area of the brain we've talked about quite a bit already, the amygdala. And the amygdala, in lots of ways, is the center of aggression of the brain. We should be very skeptical by now of a word center, the notion that there's any center in the brain for anything. This is a part of the brain that is highly implicated, highly relevant to understanding aggression. Now, what's the sort of evidence for that by now? We know the approaches. You go in and you lesion the amygdala, you experimentally destroy the amygdala in a laboratory animal, and you get an animal who has lost the capacity for aggression. Take out this part of the brain, aggression goes down, and what you have to conclude is, ooh, that part of the brain had something to do with mediating aggression in the first place. The lesion approach. And remarkably, what is stated as either an experimental approach, you go in and you destroy the amygdala of a laboratory animal, or occasionally an accident, a human damaged in their amygdala, and you see the same thing where it's destroyed. Every now and then, though, a few decades back, people would go in and intentionally surgically destroy the amygdalae of people, and this was an enormously, just incendiarily controversial procedure back when court-ordered amygdalectomies, a notion that go in and destroy this part of the brain and intractably violent, aggressive humans become much less so. And this, of course, is a more modern version of all of the horror stories of lobotomies, frontal lobotomies, a notion of often trying to fix something that ain't broken, the notion of can we ever do something like that to another person. Nonetheless, what those studies showed was, in some cases, destroy the amygdala of a person, and some of these were done in the United States, and aggression goes down. Okay, so the lesioning approach. You also have the approach of electrically recording from the amygdala. What are the circumstances that cause those neurons to have action potentials? We can have the converse approach, now putting an electrode and stimulating there and seeing, aha, this does not produce feeding behavior. This does not produce singing of opera. This produces aggression. This seems to be a part of the brain that mediates it. More modern techniques, functional brain imaging, looking at activity in parts of the brain while thoughts, while behaviors, while emotions are going on, using brain imaging to do that, and once again, amygdala implicated in this. Another bit of evidence implicates the amygdala as well. And some people of the right age, or the right sort of penchant for trivia, will remember the name Charles Whitman. Charles Whitman, back in 1966, was a young man of extraordinary potential, an Eagle Scout, a serious musician, a fine boy next door, all that sort of thing, who one day inexplicably climbed the tower at the University of Texas and opened fire on the crowd below, killing 13, wounding 34 others. And this was the first case where they rounded up the neighbors who got to say, oh, such a nice boy and so quiet, and we don't understand. The first case of not understanding the unexpected outburst of serial murder, of mass slaughter by the boy next door, and Whitman killing himself in the process, and upon examination afterward, a tumor in his amygdala, compressing the amygdala quite dramatically. Okay, so evidence for the amygdala being involved. And what we've learned now from our neuroanatomy is what you want to do to get any insight into the amygdala is to immediately ask what projections go into the amygdala. What parts of the brain does the amygdala get sensory information from? What parts of the brain does it send information to thereafter? And what we see in this diagram is very informative. What influences the amygdala? Stress hormones. lots of receptors for glucocorticoids, lots of receptors for testosterone, lots of pathways that send information to the amygdala about pain, about fear, and this is a theme we'll come back to frequently. The amygdala is the place that teaches us the lesson of how intertwined fear and pain and anxiety and frustration are with aggressive acts. Also, the amygdala gets sensory information. Sight, sounds, well, of course. What's most interesting there is it gets it through two different routes. One is information slowly meandering through the cortex, and we've seen plenty of how this works, and eventually the cortex lets the amygdala know some very detailed sensory information. What is it, that face you just saw? What sort of expression? What sort of movements in the periphery of your visual field? However, at the same time, there's an alternative loop, a faster little side loop that gets to the amygdala with sensory information. And it's got two characteristics that tell us a whole lot about impulsive violence. First off, it's real fast. It's much faster than this cortical route of sensory information. And second, it's not very accurate. It doesn't send very detailed pictures of exactly what the expression was. It sends very, very rough, crude stuff, and it's a pathway which in lots of ways is more powerful in influencing the amygdala than the more detailed sensory system. That's a world of just peripheral vision, and suddenly you act. That's a world of friendly fire, of shooting before you have time to recognize that's your uniform, not their uniform. Extremely informative. And where does the amygdala talk to? Projections out running the autonomic nervous system, of course the sympathetic nervous system, projections regulating, stimulating the release of more stress hormones, projections to motoric parts of the body, of course causing those muscles to flail out, sending that message to pull that index finger to pull the trigger. The amygdala is really logically wired up for making sense of these behaviors. Now, this whole notion of fear, the amygdala fear, and we've heard about the amygdala being hyperactive in people with post-traumatic stress disorder, fear, what does fear have to do with violence? Lots and lots. An endless theoretical sort of stance is explaining the connection. Mainly, you just see, in terms of the biology, the neurobiology, you cannot understand aggression outside of the context of organisms feeling fearful, feeling threatened. And the transition from flight to fright is overwhelmingly when an organism feels like they've got no way out, there's no capacity for flight, and that's where you get the transition from the amygdala about fear and escape to the amygdala about violence instead. Now, what's striking is making sense of the things that we fear and what the amygdala has to do with it. And there are things that we fear innately. We don't need repeated experience to understand that pain is something we fear, find aversive, try to avoid. There are parts of the amygdala that mediate pure instinctual, hardwired aspects of fear, but far more importantly, there are parts of the amygdala that learn like crazy, long-term potentiation, things of that sort, where you can condition fear, where you can associate fearful responses and sympathetic outflow with stimuli, with information that never once occurred to you before as being bad news until you get the experience to prove it to you. And what you wind up seeing is these aspects wind up becoming overly active, increased metabolism, as shown in this diagram, with individuals when they suffer trauma, post-traumatic stress disorder. And what you get, as shown on top, a circumstance of being shown a frightening face, and metabolic activity will increase in the amygdala. And we know exactly, we can construct a pathway by now going from your eyes all the way into those neurons and depolarization, excitation of those neurons. And then shown on the bottom, you put someone through stress and trauma, and this is an amygdala for the same stimulation will activate far more, far longer, and we will look shortly at the cellular mechanisms that explain that. So the amygdala here is playing a very central role, and we already heard some of the most disturbing aspects of the amygdala. For example, it lighting up metabolically when we see a face of another race. Ooh, that's real disturbing. And just as you're about to attribute that to the part of the amygdala having everything to do with the hardwired innate aspects of fear, seeing instead in the last lecture, this is learned, this is conditioned, this is associational, and when you present it in very different ways, you don't get that outcome from the amygdala. Now, another feature of what the amygdala does is very, very informative, again, for making sense of another highly specialized aspect of human aggression. In males, the amygdala activates metabolically during sex. A part of the brain, which probably is playing a role there in sympathetic arousal, speeding up your heart, all that sort of thing. But what we see is a part of the brain intimately involved in the arousal of violence is also involved in the arousal of sexuality. More insights into the subset of us who pathologically intertwine the two. Now, the amygdala, of course, is not the only place that's relevant in the brain. And one of the themes that already came through in the limbic system is all the different parts of the limbic system yelling at the hypothalamus and try to inhibit each other. A world of this part of the brain tends to work as the accelerator, this part is the brake. And there is a brake, metaphorically, in the limbic system as well, a part of the limbic system called the septum. And you better bet both the amygdala and septum send their projections to the hypothalamus. You better bet that our collateral projections coming off from an axon to inhibit some other neuron laterally, that's the wiring between the amygdala and the septum. One of them gets excited and is trying to shut the other one down. In a broad sort of way, the septum does exactly the opposite of the amygdala. And what's the sort of evidence for that? Exact same experimental techniques destroy an animal septum, and metaphorically, you've just cut the brake. You now have a system that is out of control in terms of aggression, and the term that's given for this is septal rage, where you get animals that are uncontrollably aggressive, lab rats, and this is a rather disturbing thing to have to deal with. Again, the same approaches, destroy this part of the brain, stimulate this part of the brain, record electrically from it, and begin to see what it's got to do with this behavior. So in this very broad, simplifying way, the amygdala and the septum working in opposition. Now, another part of the brain people used to think was involved in aggression, and this is one called the lateral hypothalamus. It's just a pathway going through the hypothalamus. People used to think a few decades ago that this was absolutely central to aggression. How come? Because you take some lab rat and you put a mouse in its cage and you stimulate that part of the brain and it savagely leaps out and kills the mouse and rips it to shreds and all that sort of thing. Meanwhile, you do the same thing with a dog and stimulate its lateral hypothalamus and it savagely leaps upon the bag of Purina dog chow and rips it open. Oh, this isn't aggression, this is feeding. And you stimulate that part of the brain in a carnivore, in a predator, as is the case with a rat who commits muricide, the term for rats kill mice. And what you see there is this is a behavior that's got nothing to do with violence. It has to do with getting your morning cereal in your cup, sort of in your bowl, wherever you put your morning cereal. And in this case, this sort of sent people down the wrong path for years, inadvertently confusing one set of behaviors with each other. Ow, what do we need? Let's get ourselves an ethologist to show up here and tell us what's the appropriate naturalistic setting for that behavior. Oops, we just spent the last decade studying the wrong behavior, attributing it to a different category, interviewing the animal in its own language. Now, another part of the brain gets very active during violence. And this is brainstem, hindbrain areas. And well, that sounds very interesting. That sounds kind of informative. This is an area of the brain centrally involved in mediating violence. And this, in fact, is an incredibly boring observation. Simply because you take those parts of the nervous system and they get just as metabolically active during euphoria, during any... These are the parts of the brain that say, speed up the heart, make you breathe faster, and whether you are exhaling and breathing in wildly because you're about to be violent or because you just won the lottery, nonetheless, you have to speed up your heart. This is a non-specific part of the nervous system. And essentially, you look at those neurons and when they're having action potentials, and you cannot tell if the person has just murdered somebody or just had an orgasm. It's non-specific arousal. And this brings up a concept that's going to run through the coming lectures, a concept that could be stated neurobiologically, but instead has been stated just in a beautifully poetic way by Elie Wiesel, Nobel laureate, concentration camp survivor, who has spent much of his life since then writing about the context, the philosophical implications that we have to deal with in a world that could commit the sort of violence that he experienced firsthand. A wondrous quote of him that he uses often: the opposite of love is not hate. The opposite of love is indifference. And in his context, what he is saying is there is this imperative to remember the lessons of history, to remember the lessons of your own history, and even more importantly in some ways, the lessons of others' history of suffering. If we don't learn the lessons of history, we're destined to repeat it. The opposite of love is not hate. The opposite of love is indifference, being indifferent to the history that somebody else has experienced, never again either to yourself or somebody else's suffering. And applied in this case, what you see on a remarkable neurobiological level in areas of the brain like this, the opposite of love is not hate. In this case, there is a remarkable biological intertwining between the arousal we feel in our most commendable, our most pleasurable, our most euphoric states, and the arousal we feel in the most violent ones. And that gives us a hint of the neurobiology of why we can so often confuse those two states. So this sets us up now for looking in the next lecture at, in some ways, the most interesting part of the brain when it comes to understanding why some of us are violent and others not, the frontal cortex.
Lecture 20, The Neurobiology of Aggression, Part 2.
Welcome back. Continuing with our attempt at an integration of everything that's gone on before in this course, all of our different disciplinary approaches, applying them now to understanding, trying to understand the biology of violence. What we did in the last lecture was, after looking at the remarkable heterogeneity of what counts as a violent act, a violent thought, looking at the ways in which we're just like every other animal out there in our ways of violence, ways in which we are unlike any other animal out there, and then beginning our first step to the left in our inevitable chart, trying to understand the neurobiology of violence. And no surprise, where we centered ourselves in was the limbic system, and in particular, the amygdala. The amygdala, its role helping to mediate violence, as we saw the role of the septum in doing just the opposite, and as we saw at the end, aspects of the brain involved in arousing the sympathetic nervous system, being turned on during aggression, but being turned on during many other states of arousal, and seeing this critical truism, love and hate, neurobiologically, are remarkably similar. Now, what we pick up with in this lecture is a notion that ran through the whole sections on the limbic system. The limbic system sitting there and in that sort of schematicized version of the brain, floating above it, the cortex. And that point back in those lectures, the cortex, the human cortex especially, has means to regulate, sends projections, sends axons into the limbic system like crazy. And the particular area of the cortex that is most interesting is the frontal cortex. You will recall back from the introduction to the limbic system that once heretical view that the frontal cortex, in fact, should be thought of as part of the limbic system. Crazy. What is clear now is the frontal cortex is absolutely central to understanding limbic function. As we will see, it is absolutely critical to understanding aggression, the neurobiology of it. Critical role for the frontal cortex, sufficiently so that I've spent the last 25 years studying the hippocampus. I start and end each day thinking about the hippocampus, and it occurs to me I've been studying the wrong part of the brain all these years. The frontal cortex is fascinating. Now, if you want to understand what the frontal cortex does, in a single phrase, in a single concept, the frontal cortex makes you do the harder thing. If you're in a circumstance where there's the temptation of an easy out, and then there's the hold on, don't do it, you'll regret it in the long run, the harder thing, it's the frontal cortex that's critical to doing that. If you want an incredibly outdated concept from psychoanalysis. The frontal cortex is your superego. The frontal cortex is the part of your brain that prevents you from telling the host just how awful you thought the meal was, virtually inedible. I loved it. I need the recipe. The frontal cortex makes you do the harder thing. And it does this in lots of different realms. And does this in the realm of cognition, of just thinking with pure abstract sort of thoughts, a different realm than aggression right now, of just how to do the harder thing and keeping straight of facts. The frontal cortex playing this role in what's called working memory. Not a memory of what happened in your childhood, not a memory of what today is, but you've just gotten a whole bunch of facts in the last 30 seconds, and you need to keep them going, not only the facts, but what you're supposed to do with the facts, what's called an executive function of strategically what you're doing with them, the frontal cortex juggling that stuff. And when a frontal cortex is not working properly, you see a failure of this. And you could see this in a number of different realms, sorts of tests. The classic one where you show somebody having a problem with reversing a task that's referred to as overlearned. And you might see something like this with people who often have damage in their frontal cortex, early stage Alzheimer's patients. You give them the following task. You say, okay, tell me the months of the year. Start with December. Tell me the months of the year going backwards. And the person will sit there and say, okay, December, October, September, October, November, December. It's as if they've slipped on the ice and gone in the wrong direction. What is the easier thing? What is the thing you've been doing since you're about 5 years old, counting the months of the year in one direction, September, October, November, December? What's doing the harder thing? Doing it backwards, where you need this working memory. Okay, we're at October. What comes next, November? Don't do it. Don't do it. You remember the rule that we have right now. Go in the opposite direction. And what you wind up seeing when given a bit of visual information and there's some sort of task you need to do throughout these examples, what you see is you get a signal, a light going on saying, okay, we're starting the session where every time this type of light blinks now, you do this, and that type of light, you do that. And what you see is each time one of those examples comes up, your visual cortex gets a little blip of activity there, but what you see instead in the frontal cortex is the second you get the signal, here we are doing this task, it turns on and stays on. And in this case, the visual cortex is responding to a single example. The job of the frontal cortex is to remember the rule. The rule throughout, it's the frontal cortex that makes you do the harder thing. And what it does in that realm, still looking at these cognitive examples, is it gets you to focus in on what the task is right now. And often what you would then see with somebody with this early stage dementia is after they've said the months and ultimately gone in the wrong direction, you say, okay, that's great. Now what I want you to do is start with the number 20 and count backward. And they would say, okay, 20, 19, 18, 17, September, October, November, December. And this is termed perseveration and intrusion. The previous task has come in. By now, the easier thing is to just switch back to what you were doing instead of this working memory demand. Do the harder thing. No, we're doing something new. Remember, we're doing something new. The frontal cortex is playing this role in cognitively doing the harder thing. Far more interesting to us is the role of the frontal cortex in the realm of emotion and emotionally related behavior of doing the harder thing, when the temptation is to do the easier. And the first example of this is one of the most famous of all patients in all of medicine, famous individual, a man named Phineas Gage, about whom there's been books written. Phineas Gage, a railroad worker in Vermont in the 1840s, a sobriety, reliable man who was a foreman there, and one day some horrible accident, dynamite blowing up, and a long metal rod blew out Phineas Gage's frontal cortex in one side, out the other, remarkably enough, knocked him on his rear, and he got up and dusted himself off and was partially able to walk over towards the doctor a mile away, who, using current techniques in 1840s, looked in the empty space there and said, oh my, no frontal cortex. And, you know, work conditions being what they were then, the guy in charge saying, tell you what, Gage, take the rest of the day off. And Gage comes back to work and not only figuratively, but literally being transformed overnight. This sobrietist man, never able to work again, becoming this profane, disinhibited, sexually aggressive, socially inappropriate man who died 10 years later or so, penniless, never able to stably work again. All of those, as the doctor at the time termed it, all of those animal excesses released by damage to the frontal cortex. And in lots of ways, that is as good as any modern interpretation of what this part of the brain is about. You see another type of dementia, rather than Alzheimer's, something called frontotemporal dementia, where damage begins in the frontal cortex, and very often this starts off not as a disease of memory, but as a disease of inappropriately disinhibited behaviors, and it is often viewed as a psychiatric disorder initially. It's the frontal cortex that's being damaged. People saying things, doing things that the rest of us may think about on a constant basis, petulant, lustful, angry, childish thoughts where we would die if anybody knew we were thinking that. And in this case, as you get damaged there, you do those things. Stroke damage in older individuals, when it occurs, there are the same sort of consequences. And very interestingly, you then begin to ask, when else is the frontal cortex impaired? And it becomes impaired at a very interesting time in every single one of us on a daily basis when we're asleep at night. Not during most parts of sleep, but during REM sleep, rapid eye movement sleep, when much of your brain becomes wildly active at that point. There are parts of your sensory cortex that are more active during REM sleep than when you're even awake. And meanwhile, the frontal cortex is silent, completely offline. What's that about? We've just explained why dreams are dreamlike. You don't sit there and dream about balancing your checkbook. You dream about dancing and musicals and floating in the air and having sex with strangers and who knows what, and all the things which represent a frontal cortex gone mad and silent. That's why dreams have dream content, because the frontal cortex isn't doing much at that time. Conversely, there's a personality profile, something called repressive personality, where these are individuals very tightly regulated, people who do not like surprises, people who have very tight control over their emotions, and what you wind up seeing is, under resting circumstances, they have very elevated metabolism in their frontal cortex, squeezing their psychic sphincter shut all the time. Very, very tight control. Now, not surprisingly, the frontal cortex thus plays a major role in decision-making, deciding what's the appropriate behavior and getting you to do the harder thing. And we saw an example of this a few lectures back, and putting up a diagram, the same one as before, showing a case where if you were going to do the harder thing, it takes the frontal cortex kicking in big time. That was that scenario where you press a lever once and you get one reward, press a lever twice and you get three rewards. Ooh, be more disciplined, do the harder thing. It will pay off in the long run. And what you saw was, if the cheap, easy payoff comes 4 years from now and the harder one comes 3.5 years from now, what you wind up seeing there is you don't need to have your frontal cortex working much to be able to hold on a little bit longer. And as the tempter, the cheaper one, the easier outcome gets closer and closer, where you can just smell it, and in order to hold out and do the harder thing, you need to activate the frontal cortex more and more to pull off that bit of gratification postponement. Now, what this should begin to suggest is another realm of individuals who have frontal cortices that do not work very well. Not just when they're in their REM sleep, believing they're dancing away in some Busley Berkeley musical or some such thing, but individuals whose behaviors are wildly, inappropriately, destructively disinhibited, violent sociopaths. And there's a whole literature by now suggesting two very interesting things. Under normal resting circumstances, the level of metabolic activity in the frontal cortex is decreased in these individuals. Compared to control subjects, even compared to violent criminals without sociopathic tendencies, this is the opposite of repressive personality. This is the opposite of someone who's sitting there and tightly regulating all their emotions, and this is instead the sociopathic profile, markedly inappropriate disinhibition. Now, what's equally interesting, get some circumstance where the sociopathic individual is trying to do the harder thing. Trying to do the harder thing, not in a realm of tempting behaviors and emotions, but just give them some very straightforward cognitive task that calls for a lot of frontal activity, that calls for a lot of working memory. You're trying to remember these digits while they're also asking you to do some other task, and it's taking this concentration to pull off the same level of frontal control of behavior. They have to activate their frontal cortexes a lot more than other individuals. And thus you see under normal resting circumstances, the brake doesn't work very well and isn't being pressed on much. And in order to finally get it to work, they need to slam on to increase frontal activity dramatically. Now, given this profile, it's not surprising that when we look at the frontal cortex, it is very different in us than in lots of other species. And it's not until primates that you get some big, well-developed frontal cortex, and it's not until humans that you appear to get the frontal cortex making up a larger percentage of the brain than in any other species. It's not by accident that we're the only species that has come up with social security and retirement funds and studying really hard in college so that you get great grades and get into a good grad school and get a good job and get into a good nursing home someday. This is a very human realm of this long-term planning, long-term gratification postponement. You take some chimpanzee, and even though they are the kings of cognitive control, when you look at the rest of the animal world, they don't remotely have our ability, and it is there in the anatomy, a very different profile. Now, another realm in which you don't see the frontal cortex working very well, no surprise, are in kids. Now, one of the great myths out there is not only that the brain doesn't make any new neurons once you're a couple of years old, but that the brain is completely wired up and matured at a very early stage. Sort of the magic number that was floating around recently is the first 3 years, that sort of thing. The frontal cortex is not fully functional, does not fully insulate all those axons until you're about a quarter century old, which suddenly explains a whole lot of fraternity behavior. An adolescent frontal cortex is not fully there yet. And certainly a kid's, a five-year-old's, is not. And you could see this frontality, this cognitive disinhibition, this behavioral disinhibition in all sorts of realms. The cognitive one is so easy to see. You're playing hide and seek with your five-year-old child, and they go and hide, and then you come into the room and you say, "Here I am, where are you?" And they can't stop themselves from saying, "I'm under the piano." Boom, they've ruined the whole game there. Or they're playing the other role where they're the one who's now searching and they're counting up to 10 before they come and look. And the frontality can't be overcome, this frontal disinhibitory pull that they've recently mastered up to the number 35. And they're going 8, 9, 10, and they can't stop themselves from 11, 12, and just counting on because, wow, you've got the sequence. And no, you're supposed to stop now. Do the harder thing. Stop counting. Infants, kids, adolescents are highly frontally disinhibited, sufficiently so that in 2005, the U.S. Supreme Court said it is very, very inadmissible to execute a 16-year-old for a violent crime because simply that is a brain that is not mature enough yet to fully control impulsivity. A very important, but in my opinion, a very partial decision, but recognizing understanding development is understanding the late maturation of the frontal cortex. Now, of course, what you begin to ask is our usual question, what does the frontal cortex get information from, and where does it send its projection to? And we've left out a projection in a chart in the last lecture. Where is the amygdala getting information from? From sensory systems, that slow, precise sensory input, that fast, imprecise, crude input, pain, frustration, stress hormones. No surprise, there is a whopping great projection from the frontal cortex down to the amygdala. And it's the frontal cortex which metaphorically sending an inhibitory projection telling the amygdala, "Don't do it, don't do it, don't do it, you're going to regret it." And not surprisingly either, when you think about some of the decisions we make, the amygdala in turn sends projections back to the frontal cortex. The amygdala's state of incoherent arousal or excitation can play an enormous role in making sense of the sort of decisions that we make. And we all know that we think differently when aroused, we decide differently when agitated, and as we saw in a previous lecture, thinking in that trolley scenario, do you pull a lever in order to sacrifice someone, or do you push with your own hands? You activate different parts of the brain. We know we make decisions very differently depending on the emotional status of the setting. The amygdala has a tremendous ability to inhibit the frontal cortex and make the easier things seem irresistible. Now, making sense of some of the other projections into the frontal cortex tells us a whole lot. The neurotransmitter serotonin sends a big projection into the frontal cortex and seems to play some role in getting the frontal cortex to help you do the harder thing. And what that has done is produce a whole literature suggesting that low levels of serotonin in individual lab rats up to individual humans, low levels of serotonin are associated with impulsive behaviors. Impulsivity, disinhibited aggression, part of the frontal cortex, derives its power, its capacity to hold on and get you to do the harder things, seemingly, from these serotonin projections. Now, amid that point, there's a very equally subtle point that should be emphasized. Ooh, disinhibition, in this case serotonin, playing a role in keeping the frontal cortex from making sure you're not disinhibited. And this picture we're developing here of what disinhibition is about is violent acts, all of that. Sometimes what disinhibition is about is proposing marriage to somebody you just met the day before. This is another realm of doing the harder thing. This role of the frontal cortex is not merely to keep us from being a serial murderer. In some cases, it's to keep us from being a serial marriage proposal person or who knows what. There's lots of realms in which we regulate our behavior where there's the temptation to do the easier thing, frontal cortex, and seemingly serotonin inputs into it playing this critical role. Now, another projection into the frontal cortex using a different neurotransmitter is even more interesting. And this involves the neurotransmitter dopamine. Dopamine, pleasure, anticipation, dopamine released by cocaine, dopamine as playing this critical role in thinking, this is going to be great. And there's a fascinating literature by now showing, take a primate, a lab primate, and give it some unexpected reward, and you get a burst of dopamine in this pathway being released. And what you could then show is this fascinating transition from that same exact pleasure, that same exact reinforcement, no longer provokes a dopamine rise. It gets smaller and smaller. You're taking it for granted. When is there a dopamine rise then? 10 seconds before, when the light comes on saying, here it comes. And what the rise of dopamine is about then is the transition from reward, surprising reward, to anticipation. This is going to be great. This is going to be great. Hold on, here it comes. And what is completely built into that idea is gratification postponement. Hold on, here it comes. Press the lever once. It's going to be worth it. It's going to be worth it. And what gratification postponement is about is, in a sense, building up the strength of that pathway, LTPing it, potentiating it in some cellular level so that you can go from, this is going to be great, make the effort, press that lever once, to, come on, make the effort, press that lever 400,000 times because retirement is going to be the greatest with this pension plan. What gratification postponement, what getting more control is about is, in effect, your frontal cortex being able to hold its breath longer and longer and longer and do its job. Where is the fuel of that anticipatory discipline about? Seemingly that dopamine projection going into there. Now, all of this brings up another extremely important subtle point in making sense of frontal cortex doing the harder thing. We just saw that one version of do the harder thing is not to be a murderer. Another is do the harder thing, don't announce love to a perfect stranger, that sort of thing, that realm of what discipline counts as. But what we've been setting up in here as a subset of that is the notion of doing the harder thing, keeping you from being violent. Sure, you can't stand this person. Do the harder thing. Don't lash out verbally at them. Sure, you are in this aroused, provoked state. Do the harder thing. Don't do a violent act. Restrain yourself. Don't pull that gun out that's in your waist belt. Don't do it. But sometimes what doing the harder thing is about is doing the violent act. And we can imagine all sorts of settings where, by all logic, what you want to do is flee. What you want to do is desert, and remarkably enough, the officer blows a whistle and all of you come piling out over the top of the trench with a remarkable likelihood that you're all going to be dead in 30 seconds. And because of some set of beliefs, some set of often cultural mythologies that this is the right thing to do, somewhere in there it's the frontal cortex that's forcing you to do the harder thing. The harder thing is not always the avoidance of violence. Sometimes it's the carrying out of violence. And this insight explains to me a scene which I don't know if it has ever been documented, but seems to me just heartbreakingly inevitable that it occurred, that once some 60 years ago or so, some man came home from a long day of work, tired, exhausted, wanting to take every easy out at that point, including the moving circumstance of having to tell his children, no, I can't play with you right now. I need to work. And then his family obligations and the tugging at his heart of I'm not knowing my children well enough, goes back to work designing gas chambers that release poisons. And sometimes that's the form of discipline and doing the harder thing. And sometimes those same elements we recognize in the rest of us of making us do the harder thing can be so intertwined with violence and damage to other humans. So we see that doing the harder thing does not always merely take the form of inhibiting aggressive behavior. So this gives us a very, very fast overview of our first bucket, the neurobiology of aggression. And of course, what we need to do now on our chart is take one step to the left. What sort of environmental stimuli trigger aggression? In our ethological term, what are the releasing stimuli for aggression? And thus you round up all the usual suspects that make perfect sense. Stress, pain, frustration. Train a lab rat who's good and hungry, press a lever 10 times, you get some food, 10 times, you get some food, and change the rules. 10 times, nothing happens. Another 10, nothing coming. Frustration. Some poor innocent bystander rat walks into the cage at that point, and there's a good chance it's going to be attacked. To make sense of circumstances of violence, of many circumstances, it makes sense to look at pain and frustration and stress. And remarkably, and once you think about it perfectly logically, sustained pain, sustained stress, what does it do? It depletes that pathway in your brain of dopamine. And you are losing that fuel that tells your frontal cortex where to find the energy, where to find the means to hold on and do the harder thing. Now, a couple of other things in our environment, or things that we can take from our environment and ingest, everybody knows causes aggression. Number one, alcohol. Number two, crowding. Everybody knows this, sufficiently so that it's even considered in criminal justice realms at times. And what the literature shows is alcohol does not cause violence. Crowding does not cause violence. What you see instead is alcohol causes violence in individuals who are already prone towards it. And likewise with crowding, they do not create these behaviors, they justify them, they disinhibit them in individuals who were already predisposed in that direction. And we will come back to the endocrinology of that phenomenon shortly. Now that moves us one box to the left, beginning to look at the endocrinology of this. What do hormones, not hormones back when you were a fetus, but hormones in your circulation right now, this minute, this hour, this morning, have to do with how readily you respond to pain, frustration, stress, etc., and do whatever you do in your frontal cortex, amygdala, etc.? What do hormones have to do with it? And if we're talking hormones, by definition, we are going to have to start off with the most usual of suspects in the realm of hormones and aggression, testosterone. Testosterone is a subject that's important enough that it will take up much of the coming lecture, but we start off with this very important, straightforward endocrine question. What's the deal with males anyway? What's the problem? Why is it that in species after species, not all of them interestingly, but in the vast majority, why is it that on the average, males are more aggressive than females? What's that about? Maybe something with testosterone, and back to the endocrine research done millennia ago. When you remove the source of testosterone, when you castrate an individual, they become less aggressive. That's real important to see, because without that, it's just correlative evidence. Okay, the gender that has more testosterone tends to be more aggressive. The time of life when males have their highest testosterone levels is when they tend to be most aggressive. Late adolescence, early adulthood, with animals with seasonal mating, with seasonal bursts of testosterone. When testosterone is high, that's when you get the most aggression. Look at that. Amygdala, lots of receptors for testosterone. Sure looks like testosterone is important, and it's not until you do, as shown here on this chart, the classical endocrine manipulation, the great euphemism used for it is the subtraction approach. You remove some male's testes, you remove his source of testosterone, and is shown here schematically normal levels of aggression, and we recognize that's a crazy term in terms of what counts as normal and likewise what counts as aggression. It's 47 different categories of things. Nonetheless, what you see is remove the testes and down go aggression levels. The classic endocrine subtraction approach, and then you need to finish that up with the equally classic endocrine strategy of replacement. You've removed that source of testosterone, down goes aggression, and now you replace it, you inject the individual with synthetic exogenous testosterone, and back comes the behavior. Those are the gold standards in endocrinology of implicating a hormone in a behavior. Take it away, less of the behavior, put it back, it comes back. What we see at the bottom of the diagram, though, is the critical, more subtle version of what you actually see, a point that will dominate the coming lectures. When you castrate a male of virtually any species out there, including our own, levels of aggression, our generic umbrella term here, go from 100% not down to zero. They sure go down on the average, but they don't go anywhere down to zero, as shown here, a drop down to 25% or so. In the absence of testosterone, aggression remains. Less of it, but it still remains. And in that literature is the critical, fascinating point. The more experience an individual has had being aggressive before castration, the more the aggression is going to persist afterward. In other words, the more social experience, the more aggression is maintained by social learning afterward in the absence of this hormone. A very important point, one that we will come back to in the next lecture, looking more at this subject. No single part of the brain and no single hormone is the one that is causing this behavior.